Hi guys, so we're going to get started. Thank you everybody for coming out. My name's Amy Buckland. I'm from McGill University in Montreal, where it's warmer today than here. This vacation backfired on me. Before we get started, though, I'm just curious, how many people from Library Land are in the room? Like, how many? Yes,
I knew it.
I can't believe there's this many of us here. Wow. It's pretty wild. Well, this panel kind of came around as I was talking to some people about, you know, the demise of libraries because of the internet, you know, that old chestnut. And I was talking about how things are changing in libraries. We're no longer these warehouses, right? We actually produce our own content now. And so I was talking about this with my father, who is a third-generation newspaper man. And he found that really interesting because I worked in a newsroom for 8 years as well. And there's a lot of similarities between news creation and libraries, really. So we were talking about this type of stuff, and then so we started thinking about how we are similar, and we're both local, right? We both focus on our immediate communities. If you're a reporter, that's what's important to you. And if you're a library, pretty much everything you do, from your programming to the books that you choose, has to do with your community. You're not buying them for anybody else. So we have that in common. We also like to record things. You know, libraries, we like to record them to the nth degree. But if you even just think about, like, the concept of the card catalog, like, that's a record of a history of a space. This is the things that we collected in this community over the past 100 years. It's a really interesting record. And, of course, that's what newspapers and publishers do. They like to record things. So we also have that in common. We're very networked, libraries. People working in library land, we know this. When people are like, oh, do you use books all day? And you're like, oh, isn't that cute? No. So, I mean, in my job, I deal with massive data sets and stuff like that. So we're networked. And we're also networked in terms of our collaborative nature. We like to form groups of libraries, get together to do some purchasing. We like to do these things. And the same thing with newspapers and with publishers. They stay networked because that's how you best serve your community. And finally, we tell stories, too. So now there are libraries that publish, they bought espresso book machines, and they publish the local histories for their community. They do a number of things like that. They have a teen blog, and they send the teens out to take photos and act like photojournalists for the community, and then they publish them online. So we're all about telling stories. So that's what the panel's going to do today. We're going to tell a few stories. We're going to do a little bit of a musical chairs type thing, so whoever's speaking will be located here, so just give us a few minutes to switch. And everybody will introduce themselves because they know themselves better than I do. So with that in mind, Nate, you ready?
Sure. Hey, folks. My name is Nate Hill. I'm a web librarian at the San Jose Public Library. And I am super excited to be here today talking to all of you. I want to give you basically an idea. This is sort of something I've been thinking about, and I wanted to throw this idea at this crowd and have you guys think about it a little bit. The idea here is to turn your public library into a local publishing entity. And there are two sort of pieces to this whole thing. At sort of like the crux of the whole argument is this idea that public libraries now need to think just as much about supporting the production of knowledge in the community as they do about the consumption of knowledge in the community. So that the idea has always been in public libraries that we have vast stores of media, right? And people can come in and consume that media. They read books and they, listen to music and everything else. But we need to start thinking about the flip side of that and the entire creative process. So here I want to sort of get to the point of what all libraries have in common so that we're all sort of talking on the same page here. These are the sort of four concepts that I think that you can take and look at as the glue that sticks together all the libraries out there. So whether you're talking about public libraries or academic libraries or iTunes as a library, you can take and you can find these four pieces. So look, you've got content. That's sort of the obvious part, right? You immediately jump to think books. But content could be something else in a different library. If we are talking about something like iTunes, we're talking about the music files, right? Context is the piece in which you sort of get the curatorial role that happens a lot of the time with the librarians being involved, right? When your public library has a collection development plan and they decide to curate the collection by bringing in all of these specific books, that's creating a context for the information. Likewise, if you go to your public library and you're talking to the librarian at the reference desk and you get some kind of recommendation or something like that, then they're creating a different context for that information as well. This gets into the conversation piece where, you know, it's not just about the interactions with professional staff at the library, but, you know, this is easiest to sort of think of in terms of a social network these days, right, in which people can make recommendations to one another. And, of course, all of these things come together to form community. You can flip it over the other way around and say a community might come together to always organize the other three. That's a whole other conversation. Is everybody sort of on board with that? Does that make sense to the whole gang here? All right, cool. So the next piece is just, and I think this is probably pretty clear in this room, that we've at this point moved from being kind of a read-only information society to a read-write information society, right? It is just as easy to contribute to things as it is to just simply consume them. And that's, of course, because of the internet, right? So, what I'm saying here in the slide basically is that, like, it is just as easy to write and distribute a book now as it has always been to simply read one. Same thing with photo and video. Just as easy to snag that, edit it, mash it up, change it around as it has been to view it. And the same thing with music. You guys all down with that as well? All right, excellent. So, how are we going to support these kinds of activities properly in the public library? This is when I get into the two-part plan thing that I was talking about. The first part would be through a change in facilities and what we do in the facilities. It's largely to start thinking about public computing in a totally different way. I'm of the opinion that we don't do public computing particularly well in libraries. We just have big banks of computers that all do the same thing. We can start thinking about media labs, as many libraries are. I'm going to show you one particular design pattern for a media lab that I think would be easy to reproduce in different libraries across the country. The other part of it is more of a software part. So we have this thing in libraries. Now, I know there's a lot of librarians in the audience, but in case you're not familiar, there's this thing called the ILS, which is our Integrated Library System. This is sort of the nerve center of a library. It's your catalog. It's the software that checks things in and checks things out. Without it, I don't know what the heck we'd do. I'm suggesting that we could change the way we do this and turn the ILS into an ILPP, the Integrated Library Publishing Platform. And I'll explain all of this in detail with some pictures and stuff. So let's go back to the Media Lab piece. I want to sort of promote this particular approach, though there are a lot of different good approaches to putting a Media Lab in a public library. LibraryLab.org is where you can find the full-on plans for this. This is a project that I worked on with the incredibly smart people at Knoll and Tam Architecture, as well as with somebody from the Wikimedia Foundation. And, what we did is we basically broke down the different activities that that are involved in media production. So think of something like scanning as one kind of activity. Think of audio production as another kind of activity. We basically tried to make different modules for all of the different kinds of productive activities that you might do in the library. This is just a pretty slide of the, they're called Penrose tiles. And the idea was that this architecture was going to be made only from things of this shape, so we'd be able to snap together different units. This will all be a little clearer with some of the beautiful design work that the guys at Knoll and Tam did. So this would be an example of a digital design station. You could scale the size of this depending on your need at that particular library. You could scale the actual materials depending on your budget at the library. I am going to kind of rush through all of this. There's a lot more information on librarylab.org, but I want to get to all of the other pieces of this whole thing. So we have another example would be the collaboration station, in which, you know, depending on your audience, this might look different in different ways. Eventually, the goal is to have all of these things basically printable, right? We'll have open source designs online. So if you didn't like the way that this worked, you'd be able to hack it up, change it, and have it fabricated the way that you like it. There's no reason this kind of thing has to happen in your library. This could be a library project that these become little kiosks that are inserted into the community and other places. So that's sort of the part one of the publishing platform, in that in these kinds of instances, you'd be sort of producing single-channel media, things like the audio, things like the video, so that if you were doing something like going to the point of making an ebook, then you would have a facility to create the components of that ebook. And then we get into the publishing platform. Again, more of a software solution. So I want to give you a sort of an example that'll hopefully clarify the whole thing. Imagine that you're in Austin here, and there's some guy named Bill who is like the local barbecue expert. He knows everything about barbecue in this town. And he has decided that he wants to write a book about, you know, the guide to the best barbecue in this town. The process for that is sort of complicated, right? What I'm proposing is that Bill would be able to go to his public library, he'd be able to log on, and he would be able to click a button that says create project. And when he starts creating that project, he would essentially be generating a record in the library catalog, and he would start working on his book. So when somebody else comes to the Austin Public Library and they decide to look up barbecue, then not only do they get all of the long-known knowledge that has always been there, but they get Bill's work in progress as well. So Bill is essentially creating an ebook on the fly that you're going to find in the library catalog, right? And so can anybody else who is doing it. So then, of course, the next step is that we would want some kind of filter, because maybe Bill's an idiot, right? Maybe Bill has no clue about the barbecue around here. So you can imagine that it would be relatively simple to set something up where Bill's book is being voted up or voted down, depending on how good it is, by the community, right? It's also a great opportunity. Another kind of filter would be, say Bill's book is super amazing, and we want it to turn into a real print book that's going to be on the shelf at the library. Well, there's no reason you couldn't insert some kind of Kickstarter-like thing here, in which people not only wanted to vote Bill's book up to the top because it was so good, but they wanted to contribute like $3 or $4 so that it could actually get published. And then another one would be at the library. Whoops, went the wrong way. And so, you know, that's what I'm saying here, is that we can actually take and we can bring the book back around to the library. And so I have some basic graphic examples here of the same thing. This is what it looks like if in San Jose you look up dogs in our catalog. These are the results. Now, imagine if you look up dogs and there's my work in progress. I have a really wonderful dog who drives my neighbors crazy. Who knows if this is something that people really care to see printed, but certainly we could apply the filter. And then this is sort of just a basic graphic example of what I'm talking about, how you could vote things up to the top. So I hope that, I think that's pretty much all I have. I just hope that we're going to be able to discuss it a little bit. I'd love to hear what you guys think about this idea and where it could go. And I really want to thank you for your time. Next up.
Yep.
Me?
Yeah.
Awesome. Actually, I'll just stay here.
Make sure that mic's on.
Yeah. Okay. It's on.
It's on?
Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. I know there's a lot of options, and so we're glad that you're here with us. That was great, Nate. Thank you very much. Hi, I'm Michael Porter. You might know me online as Library Man, though I've backed away from Library Man in the last couple of years for a couple of reasons. The biggest reason you'll hear more about as we work through the presentation. So I always like to try to make funny slides, although sometimes they just look really cheesy like this. So we're here talking about making stories, libraries and community publishing. And so I thought my little mini presentation here could be called Take a Chance on Me, The Dangerous World of Your Local Library's Publishing Infrastructure. And by dangerous, we'll talk about what that means. And you can't read it, but that little record is by the Savvy Librarians, and it says library publishing is a dangerous world. Not that I really needed to point that out to you. So let's talk about what worked in libraries, and this totally ties back to publishing. We're going to take a little trip here and come back to publishing with a little background. So when you think about what made libraries work, these kinds of libraries, sort of old school libraries, what made that work? Well, lots of things made that work. Awesome librarians, the role that libraries fill in society, the role that libraries fill in local communities. No other institution is designed to do that, and it does unique things for democracy and society at large. So they fill a very important role. It is part of our human nature and our human need that will continue as we continue being human beings. So lots of what the library did then is great, but we have a problem right now. And the problem is that what made a lot of what worked for libraries then, what made that work as far as access to content, it just doesn't work anymore. Parts of it work, but we're seeing things emerge. Obviously, we all have our Kindles or see people in our libraries with Kindles or program for Amazon. I don't know who's in the room. But as there's this sea change of methods to access content, that part of what libraries have done for hundreds of years is in crisis. And so when we're thinking about this, there's a couple assumptions that I think are true that we can all be on the same page with. Technology makes libraries more relevant and useful. That's just a fact. So it's incumbent on us, if we're going to fulfill mission in society that we're designed to fulfill, that we have to embrace technology effectively. I would posit, and you'll see a couple points about this, that libraries really, we do amazing things with our resources, but there's an infrastructure that's been created to support what we do when it comes to electronic content access and distribution and acquisition that, unless you're really into libraries, you don't really probably know a lot about it or maybe even care. I mean, why would you? But the problem is the roles that libraries fill, nothing else does that. And if we don't figure out how to build a bridge that works for libraries to allow us to get access to e-content in efficient, affordable ways, there's a real problem. And that ties in with publishing, and I'm going to wrap up with how that ties in with publishing. But, you know, communities really need libraries to thrive. And, of course, more and more people are accessing content electronically. They don't need the physical object nearly as much. So they're working with digital movies and e-books, multimedia, zeros and ones, right? They need devices and they need infrastructure to facilitate their consumption of zeros and ones. So what this means for libraries, we need new solutions. We need new things so that people can get what they want, when they want, how they want it through the library, from the publishers, from the self-publishers, from the creators. And that doesn't exist right now effectively for libraries. So whatever we create, we have to make something substantial, and it also has to be highly functional and really practical and on par with the commercial alternatives that are available, the iTunes, the Netflix, the Amazon. And that's a huge challenge for a series of nonprofit organizations that are in local communities that have incredibly tight budgets who are often resistant to change. We believe that this really needs to happen pretty quickly. Now, that's not necessarily the attitude that is going to help us get this done right, is saying now, it has to be now. And that's part of the problem, is we have to take a measured approach. But time is of the essence. If publishers, and be they giant organizations or individuals, are going to get their materials to people through libraries and have them archived and all the good things libraries do and build up the content with community, we have to have this infrastructure. So when it comes to taking a chance on libraries, this is maybe a little too obvious, but when you look at cassette tapes or older particular style film cameras or rotary phones, typewriters, those sorts of things, we see what's happening with technology. And that gun is pointed right at the physical book. We're still going to have books. And there'll still be plenty of kids' books and reference books. And we'll still have books, but we need to have an infrastructure that lets us get electronic content as good as all the commercial alternatives. And we just don't have that right now. And really, it boils down to money, as you see up there in the corner. But the situation libraries find themselves in is they need money, and we get little drips and drabs. We get little tiny little presents. When we're thinking about creating a new infrastructure that publishers and individuals could use to get content to people through libraries, there's more libraries in the United States than Starbucks and McDonald's. So use that numeric power to greater advantage using technology with a different platform that facilitated acquisition and access of e-content that was open to publishers, individuals, whatever kinds of – that's what libraries need. That's the kind of infrastructure we need to build, and it simply does not exist, and there aren't major initiatives to make that exist. And so rather than sitting around and waiting for somebody to make something that would work, a group of us got together about 3 years ago and started working on this nonprofit called Library Renewal, which is where I work. And I'll just say this so I don't forget. A lot of the images and many more in the little zine we made. If you want to get copies, they're usually you have to donate on the site to get them, but they've got a little stack of them here. We've got little buttons and stickers. We've got 3 t-shirts of Library Renewal if you want to come up. Having said all that, this group of folks got together to figure out how could libraries create an infrastructure that would let publishers, whatever scale they're on, from individual to giant publishers, sell rights to distribute content to libraries so libraries could get people the e-content that they wanted. And, of course, we're talking about books and e-books, but we're also talking about whatever sets of zeros and ones people want. So it could be music or movies. So the infrastructure we need to create will facilitate the transfer of those zeros and ones. And that's what Library Renewal is working on. And I just wanted you to know about Library Renewal and our work and encourage you to reach out to us and learn more about it, because that's really what we're working on. So there are a whole bunch of notes, and I do a lot of presentations all over the country. If we had an hour or 90 minutes, I'd be able to cover all this stuff. But we'll be putting this up online, of course, on SlideShare probably, and wherever else. It's up on the South by Southwest site too, right? Yep. So you can see these notes. But these are a lot of the issues around publishing and libraries. You need micro examples. You need macro examples. You need to know how traditional publishing has worked for the last 100-plus years and how the companies that control that, what they're doing to try to maintain their control in a world that they're not experts in by nature. And we're seeing huge tumult because of that. Tumult brings opportunity. But instead, what we're seeing on the library perspective is obfuscation from the vendors that are selling things to libraries. We don't know how much extra money. Well, Library Renewal has been researching this for the last year, and we've cracked that nut. But they don't tell us what their markups are or what they're spent for. And it's troublesome. And when you really dig down into it, like we have over the last year doing all this research, and you learn what the markups are, and then you think about what the successful institutions like Apple and iTunes and Amazon that have created solutions, they've totally broken the mold for publishing and distribution in the ways that they could. And look what Amazon's doing with publishing too, right? And they've applied it to a method that allows them to generate revenue. Libraries would like a piece of that business in a way that helps support the library's existence. And we believe that's entirely possible, and we want Library Renewal to be a tool, simply a tool to facilitate that happening. Who are we to do this? But we get what's going on in the market, and we want a place where people like you can come and be a part of the movement that will make this happen. So I would say, let's take a chance on libraries. Let's do it and come and get some spiffy buttons and stickers and shiny t-shirts. And talk to me afterwards, please. I have cards and everything. Okay, great. Who's next?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Fancy t-shirt. Just to bide your time while we're switching musical chairs.
That's actually a Library Renewal dress for me.
It is.
So bring a belt. All right. Hi, everyone. Let me get on the appropriate slide and start the timer because I have a tendency to run on. My name is Char Booth, and I'm a Texan moonlighting in California as an academic librarian, so I'm glad to be home. And if you're tweeting right now, I'm at Charbooth. Very simple. So what I'm going to be talking about today is Breaking the Bank, library publishing as a means of encouraging learner engagement in higher education. So the type of librarianship I do at the Claremont Colleges, which is where I work, is mostly trying to figure out how libraries and librarians can enhance student learning and also enhance teaching, right? So the library is becoming more involved in the pedagogical mission of the university, which I hope continues. It's a very important thing that we transition into. So Nate and Michael before me have talked a little bit about the kind of maker ethic in public libraries and library infrastructure. So I'm coming at it from a little bit of a different angle. So think about student work as a made object, right? As kind of a something that a lot of students have to engage in. And how many people actually ever wrote a paper in college? Everybody. Okay, how many people wrote like 20 or 30? Maybe more. Where are they now? Where are they?
In a box.
Do you know where they are? Right, on a hard drive that nobody else can read. Right. So this is the problem that I'm going to talk about today. So how does that disconnected, trashed, old hard drive, lost to the ether work become more meaningful through library publishing platforms? All right. So the blue dot on this slide is a student. Okay, so just remember that. Blue dot equals student. So in a typical life cycle of a scholarly, you know, thing that a student produces, they're given a set of criteria. They write a paper, they do a project, they produce this thing, which then they throw into this black kind of like box, the grading machine. Okay, the grading machine eats the paper, masticates it along with a bunch of other work that was created by their peers that they never see, right? So the student doesn't really see this happening. It's happening in this black box. And, you know, grades are assigned to the papers. And if you have a great professor, they tell you why you get the grade that you get. And you're actually given criteria that helps you understand why you got that grade. Paper either, you know, in the form of a letter grade or the actual object itself is returned to you. And if you go to a fancy liberal arts college like the one I work for, you might actually get some commentary. If you have a low enough student-to-teacher ratio, you can get some feedback that helps you learn about what you did and why it could be done better or, you know, how you excelled. So the problem with this model, you do an assignment. You throw it into the black box spits it back, but you don't understand what's happening in there. You don't see the work of your peers, you don't get why it matters, and it doesn't last. It disappears. This was always a product problem for me when I was a student, and I went to a fancy liberal arts college, right? So I did get that substantive feedback, and I did feel like my work was meaningful because people were telling me that it was meaningful, but it still disappeared, okay? And when I tried to gain access to that disappeared work, you know, it's just gone forever. So basically what students do a lot of the time is mimic the process of scholarship. Scholarship is a public endeavor. People engage with one another. They communicate when they produce scholarship. And student work is divorced from that communication loop. It's basically like you're miming what it means to communicate in the scholarly conversation. So you're like watching it. And you're kind of like, you know, just mimicking it. And that's the problem with that I have here with this kind of stuff. So what I'm going to do now is lean on some really smart people to explain how we might start to rethink this and use the tools that libraries provide to kind of shake this thing up and make student learning more meaningful in a couple of ways through libraries. Okay, so how many people know who Mr. Paulo Freire is? Who is he, Jasmine? Right. Exactly. So back in 1970, Paulo wrote this awesome book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed, the oppressed being all those papers in that black box. They can't get out. They're in jail. Okay, so what he wants us to do is connect learners with the process of scholarship more meaningfully, right? So don't just dump them full of facts, which is what the banking analogy in my title is. The banking problem in higher ed is that we just kind of think of students as repositories, we dump stuff in them, and then we force them to regurgitate it at kind of opportune moments, and then it's all gone so we can dump more stuff in. So that kind of banking model is really problematic. And what I want to do is talk about different ways libraries can support taking those papers, taking those learning objects, and bringing them into the light of day, helping students see their work actually contributing to the scholarly discourse when it is good enough to do so. Okay, so I'm not talking about everything. I'm talking about the stuff that excels, helping students see how to excel and take advantage of these tools. All right, so I'm moving on to John Dewey, my personal philosophical boyfriend. He's really wonderful. So John Dewey was the guy who basically came up with this idea of active learning. Okay, so you take the dot, the blue dot, and you connect it to the product of its own labor. Okay, so this is kind of pre-Marxist awesomeness. So people learn when they're doing stuff that actually matters to their life, when they're engaging practically, when they're creating output that other people will care about. So I'm going to get to how we actually help them do that in just a moment. So now I'm going to talk about Jack Mesereau. He's a little bit more contemporary than Mr. Dewey, but arguably, you know, somewhat as awesome. So Jack Mesereau came up with the theory of transformative learning, which is that when you're an adult, when you learn meaningfully, your concept of doing things changes, right? So your fundamental critical reflection on what something means, such as writing a paper, can transform itself into something that has a lot more impact to your life. Okay, so what I'm talking about is taking that black box, right, and breaking it down, making it permeable, helping students see the work of their peers, and helping their work kind of like float to the surface of this endeavor called college and university. Because what it is now, typically, is a hurdle to jump over to get a credential to help you get a job. And that is not significant, right? You do things rolling your eyes, and you sigh, and you get sad, and you eventually get out, or you don't, right? So I see this all the time. I work directly with students a lot who are working on projects and assignments, and if they're not stoked about it, they're not going to do a good job. If they don't see why it's significant, they're not going to try, okay? Even though they're a fancy liberal arts college. So last but not least, amazing, brilliant feminist theorist Bell Hooks tells us that there is a pedagogical responsibility to treat a learner as a peer, to mentor them, to work with them, to develop them as co-learners, right? And in this case, Green Dot being the professor, the black box is now shrunk to the size of the student, and the student is in communication with the educator to help understand how and why to make their work better within the discourse of the discipline that they're engaging with, okay? So how do libraries and librarians help this peer-to-peer relationship between the learner and the educator? How do we teach students to truly be scholars, whether it's in the moment or for the rest of their life, rather than just watching scholarship go by or run them over or averting their eyes or whatever happens? So, okay, so librarians, that's a librarian. Really, it is a librarian. And libraries have a number of ways, a number of tools, and a number of platforms to help us do this. And has anyone ever heard of the third place or third space idea? Okay, one of you nodders, tell me what it is.
The first place is home, the second place is work, and the third place is where you spend the time when you're not in those other two places.
Okay.
Leisure time.
Great. That was actually really good. Did everyone hear that, or do you need me to repeat it? Say it again. Okay, so first place is home, second place is work, third place is basically where you spend your leisure time, okay? So if we transition this idea to the idea, or to the realm of scholarship and academia, if the first place is kind of the creation of student work, so the student workspace, the second place is that black box of kind of grading and criteria, the library can become a third place that connects these things more meaningfully and gives them the opportunity to kind of develop a new way for students to emerge from their educational experience with actual products that they can point to, that they can learn from, that they can engage with, and they can say, I made this. You know, and this is out there, and it's not just on a hard drive that I can't access because it's 10 years later. All right? So let me talk about a few specifics. The primary way that libraries and librarians can help facilitate students actually engaging with their work is through digital repositories, right? Okay, so the button on the screen that you're seeing is this lovely little thing that my colleagues and I designed at Claremont Colleges. What's up, Bonnie? Hey. That's my coworker. Anyway, so we basically designed this button to get students to understand the idea of the scholarly repository, and that's really too close to suppository when you're speaking. So I'm just going to acknowledge that now in case it comes out of my mouth. So, all right. Oh, upload yours. Okay, so this is the idea. Have you created something so good that you're so proud of that you want to publish it and be able to point to it when you get out of here? Right? So we're helping students understand that they have the ability, they have the volition to do that, because we're providing them with this open access platform. What's open access? Well, that's a great learning opportunity, okay? So another thing we're doing with this is actually forcing them to upload their work, which is very good trick. So the environmental analysis program at the Claremont Colleges is a really kind of awesome interdisciplinary forward-thinking developing program that deals with every aspect of environmental analysis you can possibly imagine, from the arts up to like soil chemistry and things that I'm really kind of perplexed by. So last semester, every senior in this program had to upload their thesis, their capstone project, to Scholarship at Claremont. And what we did is we worked with them to understand their responsibilities, their rights, and what makes work good enough, robust enough, and respectable enough, attributable enough to be something that someone would want to cite. Can you remember an experience like that from your own undergraduate education, if you had one? How many people? Right. So now we have this awesome opportunity, because a lot of places are developing these digital repositories, to not only have it be a place for scholarly preprints and all that awesome stuff, but say, students, it is your responsibility to produce scholarly level work, because it is going to be out there. It is going to be in Google Scholar. It'll be in BASE. You'll get an email every time someone downloads it. You'll see citation counts and everything. So needless to say, this really raised the bar. And in a communication with the head faculty member of this program, the work improved so much that the average grade decreased because the criteria had been raised so much. He was like, it's great. I don't have to give them A's anymore. No more grade inflation. Y'all have helped me actually establish legitimate criteria to grade this work with. And the students are really stoked, and they're proud of what they're doing. And when we're reading these things, myself and a colleague of mine who are working with this program, we're getting thanked in the acknowledgments as being a new type of collaborator, a new method of support. So we're mentoring these students through the process, and it's really significant. So the library's third place is also important to recognize the public forums for publication that can actually be affected by scholarly practice outside of the digital repository. So Wikipedia being a perfect example of something that is roundly, you know, criticized and, you know, treated as anathema by most scholars. Instead of complaining about it, we can actually get students and librarians and professors to fix it, to find what's wrong with it, and write articles for it, right? So this is another thing that we're doing at Claremont with politics class. So students identify articles that are incomplete, stubs, things that don't exist, and we actually teach them and help them figure out how to write an article so good that it won't get deleted by the, you know, editing core of Wikipedia. And a final way that I think is very important for individual librarians to remember is that we provide encouragement for students to see themselves as scholars. This is an example, a really good example, of one of my students that I worked with at UC Berkeley, who is a software engineer. I worked with the School of Information there, which is really like tech-focused. And he had this paper assignment. He had to write a 30-page paper. You know, he's 40 years old. He's a software engineer. He doesn't remember how to do that. And he was really stressed. So we met a couple times. We talked about it. He ended up producing this incredible thing called FYI TMI, Toward a Holistic Social Theory of Information Overload, required reading for everyone in this room. And I said, Tony, this is the best paper I've ever read. Literally, you should really submit it to First Monday. It's the perfect forum for this. It's an open access journal. It's really good. Look at the content. See if they accept you. He sends it off. They accept it immediately. He now has a published paper and is going into a PhD program because he got so stoked about that process. So we can encourage students to see themselves as scholars in addition to students, right? So that's not a typical relationship, but that's one of our responsibilities, I think. Okay, so librarians and libraries can provide the infrastructure in the form of digital repositories and the kind of inspiration, suggesting different ways to improve public platforms, knowledge bases like Wikipedia, and the encouragement to learners, individual learners or groups of learners, to see themselves as important to the process of scholarship as their mentors and other kinds of faculty. So that's my presentation. My name is Char Booth, encouraging you, as always, to love your library. And if you want to make yourself a little bit smarter, here's some suggested readings. And I also have a bunch of swag up here, too, not to be outdone by Michael. Okay. Thank you.
So these are just some examples of different ways that libraries can help publish. And I wanted to touch on a few more, just little random things. So I worked in publishing for 15 years before I became a librarian, partially because I like the idea of any community can publish. And anybody can publish. If you want to write a book, if you want to write a blog, if you want to do that type of stuff, you can do this. And libraries can help you. So making your own news, I like to think of, there's a story from a small town in Canada where the town paper shut down, just lack of, you know, advertising dollars, couldn't make it work. So they basically use their teen group to be the photojournalists for the town, and they would send them out with digital cameras. They invited some people from the community to be reporters, and they would put out a weekly blog. It was just online, and they would the sense of community that built around that, people would felt very engaged with it. And that was all just the library had some server space, held a workshop on, you know, the few ways to ask questions properly. They invited actually the editor-in-chief from the Folded newspaper to come and give a little workshop. And so that's one way that they helped start making their own news in the town, which is so important because it's always this record of a time and a place. And that's what libraries like to have. We like to have this record of a time and a place. Write your own stories. The Sacramento Public Library has this program called the I Street Press. And what they do is they actually help community, just, you know, Joe Schmo in the community who wants to write a book. He's got a book inside him. He's just trying to figure out how to do it. And so they go and there are workshops on how to write. But also what they're really finding right now that's really important is how to lay out a book, that type of stuff, so it doesn't look like a Word document printed and stapled, that type of thing. And the library was fortunate enough, they got a good-size IMLS grant to buy an espresso book machine. So they can actually print and bind for people. And I was talking to one of the people that run it, and she said, people cry when their book comes out of the machine because they're just so excited to see it in print. And that's something that the library, I mean, it's not obviously, it's got to be grant money for this type of stuff in libraries. No one has that kind of cash kicking around. Or if you do, talk to Michael and Nate because they got some stuff. But in general, it's going to be grant-based. But just to think of these ideas at your library for services and for people in the community to think of things that the library could help you with, which are really important. Libraries are really, really good at genealogy searching. We're pretty rocking at that. There's some libraries that are helping people actually do their family tree, and then they send it out to get printed on the large size. And they're doing the layout in-house. They invite students from like the graphic design program at the local college to come in and help people do this stuff. So everybody gets, you know, people do like the tangible, right? Like, people like to hold things in their hand. That's why when people joke that books are going to die, I mean, most librarians giggle because, you know, until this is waterproof and I can read it at the beach, I'm probably just going to grab a paperback with me for a lot of things. So that type of getting that type of paper is really important. And libraries were in a great position to do this. So I want to throw a question out to you guys in the community. If you're from libraries, what do you think? Do you have any stories about publishing or what you think? And if you're not from libraries, what would you like to see libraries do? Or do you think this is all kind of kooky talk and that we shouldn't do it? I'm really curious to hear from you guys. So there's a mic that's being passed around. And somebody should say, oh, yeah, thank you.
Hi, I'm Ollie Sinitas. I work at the Arapahoe Library District in Colorado. I love what you guys are doing here, but I've also thought about, I used to live in a former life, I worked in advertising, and I've always wondered why libraries don't leverage brand. Mm-hmm. And I know we're trying to transcend books, but to people we are about books. My father-in-law is an author. And all he wants to do is be able to get, he's a published author, been successful, but now he can't figure out Amazon and getting any presents. Why aren't we helping him? Yeah. We have a lot to offer, and I'm just wondering if any of you have any comment on that.
I would just posit that your question touches on the fact that libraries don't have their own infrastructure to facilitate the acquisition and distribution of e-content. And because our brand, while it is books, that will evolve over time, I believe. But because that brand is so powerful, we have huge amounts of untapped leverage. And the concern, at least for the folks that work with Library Renewal, is that that leverage will simply just be tapped to generate more revenue for a vendor ecosystem and won't be returning revenue back to the libraries that so desperately need it. And I would also say the system that we would propose gives more monies back to the authors and the publishers as well. So it's just a much more mutually beneficial, I believe, respectful arrangement that we would like to perpetuate. And the goal would be to facilitate the sorts of publishers Amy talked about, the sorts of publishers you're talking about.
And just to follow on that, I mean, libraries, we're awful at talking about what we do. Yeah. Like, at least you guys are, we're here, right, at South by? we're not at another library conference talking about libraries, which is kind of what we do. We're awesome with the echo chamber. We're so good at it. But we need to tell our communities that we can do this type of stuff. So I think, like when they think of us as books, we need to start making them think of, but we know the whole system, like, and we get this. And in scholarly publishing, too, like, we know about peer review. We know how to do this stuff because that's how we work. So I think it's a lot of, I mean, we need more advertising people in libraries.
Hey, one other thing regarding brand and the whole idea that we're about books. I think we really have a hard time being sort of a unified force as libraries across the country. And when I mostly talk about the different productive activities that could go on in libraries. And as I look at different things that happen, you know, the amazing Media Lab in Skokie, Illinois, the Library U project in Escondido, you know, the thing in Sacramento you were speaking about, mm-hmm. we have a different name and a different image that we assign to all of these things. And when libraries start to get excited about brand, they go and call themselves something like Anythink, and they come up with a whole different thing, right? Which is fine, but it's fracturing. It really is fracturing. And if there were a way that we could talk much more consistently across this entire country about producing media in the library, it would be so helpful. Where that should come from, that's a whole other question.
And having that cohesive vision would give us more street cred with publishers.
Yeah.
Right? Because we'd all be on the same page and we'd all be able to do this. And like, I worked in publishing for a long time, all different types. Publishers are not evil by any means. But when we all go to them with different little things and accept little deals on the side on this one and not on this one, like, it's, I can, hey, make it work if you can. But if we were all on the same page for this type of stuff, we'd be able to push the barriers a lot more, I think.
Is this one on? I just wanted to add that, I mean, it is, as much as all of that is absolutely true, it's also very difficult to transition from being a cultural norm to having to fight for your very existence. And at the same time, like, libraries are very good at reflecting the specifics of their communities, and that's one of our strengths. So we basically are having to go from, well, it's just a library, it's always going to be there, to, we're the library, we should really be here, and we need to leverage each other's power, but we still have to reflect the nature of our own constituents. We have to be their library. We don't want to be a franchise. So the tension is very challenging, and I think it's important to recognize that we're trying to do two things. We're juggling like two really heavy things at the same time. So it can be done, but it's hard.
I'm Richard Nash. One of the I've talked to a few people over the last couple of months who've indicated that Ingram, which is a big wholesaler of books to libraries and also has a division that does print on demand, and who has no consumer-facing capacity, unlike Lulu or Blurb, are trying to figure out how they can use libraries and bookstores to become that consumer-facing layer. And that, for libraries, wouldn't require anything like the capital outlay mm-hmm. that an espresso book machine would require. Effectively, the library would be able to send its patrons PDFs to Ingram's Lightning Source and get them delivered 1 or 20 or 100 copies a week later. That could also help crystallize perhaps the service, or at least one dimension of the
definitely.
Of community publishing service that you were talking about, into something that can be talked about across the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah,
I think that's wonderful, and I think it's worth noting that spending $100,000 on an espresso book machine is not a realistic approach for many libraries across the country.
Hi, I'm a former bookseller of about 10 years, independent bookstores, and now I work in the digital realm. And I'm curious, especially with the two infrastructure problems that sort of Char and Michael addressed, are you working with groups like Code for America and Civic Commons to sort of figure out how you can get a bunch of coders in to help you with stuff like that for free?
So I will tell you, the biggest reason I was excited to come and present is because, as Amy mentioned, we go to these library conferences, and present all the time. I'm going to Philadelphia from PLA, then I'm going to computers and libraries in DC on this trip to present about this. So my frustration is we made this organization to get we knew we need legal expertise, entertainment and publishing expertise, and business expertise. We don't have it, and we knew it. And so we wanted to make this place where, so thank goodness you are all here, because we need that. We need that, and we don't know all the places we should go, and we've got one full-time volunteer that works on this full-time, and a bunch of other volunteers. So, yes, we could definitely, if you want to get contact information, we're eager to find the right partners. We're very careful in the partners we pick, but we're, yes. So,
I mean, I think one of the things that happens in academic libraries, just to add like that angle on this, is that we're really good at using open source tools and just kind of like grabbing every free thing we can possibly grab. And I think that that's one way that we do a lot of this on a shoestring, is just to really know the landscape of what's available and how to leverage things like BPress and other. Amy, what's the awesome digital presentation tool platform?
The Omeka one?
Omeka, yeah. Things like that. I mean, just if you know the infrastructure that's out there for the taking, you can really customize things to the needs of your community. So I think that's really, it's not necessarily partnering with people to develop new tools. It's taking the tools that exist and developing them to our own needs. And again, that creates a lot of duplication of effort. But at the same time, it's that same tension, you know, duplication of effort equals people who feel like they're being served very directly in some cases. But yeah, collaboration is also super great.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Reynolds from Rutgers University. And I'm sure a lot of people in here have heard of the IMLS MacArthur Initiative, which is funding digital media centers in public libraries and also maybe school libraries towards giving youth in communities the capacity to build and develop digital media, telling stories about their communities. And I wondered what you, I mean, even though we're sort of thinking beyond the book on this panel, a lot of you are talking about offering patrons the opportunity to publish books in digital form. And I wonder what you think about also the sort of opportunity to create other forms of digital media like music, games, film, that kind of stuff. And in sort of in that vein, I wonder whether you had thought about maybe talking to software companies and, you know, thinking outside of publishing, moving beyond into maybe, you know, software technology funders and, yeah.
Can I just want to say one thing to that, and that I love the U-Media space. I've been there. I think it's really fantastic that all of this is happening. I really dislike the fact that it is associating content creation with like a developmental phase, as if it's something that should happen for teens and be targeted toward teens. Content creation has been going on in libraries since the beginning of time for kids, right? There's not a single library that doesn't have a craft program for kids out there. I think it's great that now that we're thinking about it in this sort of digital landscape that we're expanding it to teens, but I'm sure every single person in this room would be thrilled if they were able to go to their library and have access to, you know, more interesting software and actually like build and design and write things. So I love the U-Media thing. I'm glad they're putting it out there. It needs to be greatly expanded to be truly effective for the whole country.
Just to piggyback on that, when I give longer presentations, one of my slides is Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and I talk about how that plugs into why libraries are important in society and the roles they fill at the individual level, much to the point that many of the points that Char made. So that motivation, it's an internal thing, and I think of gaming and how, you know, when the Atari 2600 came out, video game, right? And now you look at WoW and how gender is irrelevant in gaming because it's human need that is being addressed, a desire that's being addressed through tools like that. So I think I think media spaces are at a developmental stage. What gets me excited for the future of libraries and any manner of different kinds of publishing is that the things that are happening and going to keep happening and get stronger are technology empowers them, and it is the perfect fit for the library in the local community to be the place where that happens. And it is at this sort of funky developmental stage, but the opportunity for renewal in libraries I would say if we have this infrastructure, it's really a critical point. But through the evolution of technology and how we integrate with it, there's huge power for libraries to be more effective and dynamic and integral to communities than they even are now in ways we can't even imagine yet. And that is incredibly exciting. Also frustrating when you go to a library and you see what some of our infrastructure is like, and it's like, God, we fill this role. Nobody can do this as good as we can. We really know how to do this. And so we're at this sort of funky stage that is exciting to think about getting through.
I just wanted to address the like analog or the physical side of that, which is that when you're talking about libraries as places for people to make things, that can be as simple as fixing their bike tire, checking out a chainsaw. You know what I mean? Like these buttons that we make, we actually buy the button presses and we publish the templates online and we invite student groups to come in and design their own designs and smash their own buttons. We give them free books. Why not give them free buttons, you know, and some mentorship on how to do this stuff? And that is incredibly popular and powerful. So as many places as you can think of giving people the things that they need to do stuff without having to buy the $400 button press for themselves, that's another way to make people makers in libraries. And it can, I mean, there, libraries as maker labs is kind of this thing that's going around, and all you need is a room and a bunch of, you know, random equipment and just like set them loose, but make sure you know how to use it too so you can teach them how to do stuff. And that's, I mean, the digital infrastructure, it's such an important component of this, but all of it wraps into itself and into this kind of this feeling that people get when they go into a library and they're able to discover that there are all these tools that they had no idea even existed that they could play with, literally. I think it's really important also to have those, you know, kinesthetic tools around as well.
That physical location, right, that third place.
Right.
And when the infrastructure that we envisage in envisioned for people to access e-content would be drastically different in that when people access an interface to acquire the content at the individual level, they'd be pushed towards things that the physical library had. So authors, visits, story times, check out, you know, a tool library that you could check tools out, whatever, you know, cool thing that would apply to the local community. Mm-hmm. So if that interface, you see the intersection, like your online life and your physical life, the role, there's just huge, exciting potential here. It's really energizing.
And just really quickly, I have a friend who's decided she's going to teach this summer a workshop on intro to programming, intro to Python, and as part of your publishing, you have to commit to GitHub and all this stuff and learn version control and that. And that's, she considers that publishing. So, and that's open to everybody because she's like, who doesn't need to know how to do a little bit of this at some point? So,
I work for a university, and I work for IT. And last year, I started a small new media center in our school's library, and also launched the first audio recording booth in the university in that. And I was wondering, you know, where I'm coming from and working in an edit bay and helping students with video and promoting that as, hey, it's cool to make video, it's how people are teaching and learning, to actually creating scholarly work. That's something that it's just a concept in my idea, like in my head, but do you have anything specific that I can sort of, say, lead people into or something specific I can do to make that integration happen?
And when you say creating scholarly work, do you mean taking the products of media and kind of publishing it and putting it out there in a forum that would be recognized as scholarship? Is that what you...
Exactly.
I would say, honestly, go to your library and say, what type of archiving and publishing tools do you make available to this institution? Because usually it is going to be the library that's doing that. And they're the ones with the expertise, and you can talk to them about the formats that you have and different ways that they have of publishing and promoting things. So that's typically the point in the organization that that's going to be happening, whether people know it or not. So what university do you work for?
St. Edward's.
St. Edward's, yeah. I actually think that they're part of a kind of consortium that does work with student work. I could be totally wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure that I know that they have kind of their tentacles in that already. Yeah.
I have one other question. They had a $13 million grant to renovate the library. Uh-huh. And
I'm like, can I have
everybody
that?
Hates us, right?
Our carpets are really gross.
But I do have a question about, and maybe it's just, y'all could throw some ideas out there, of branding what I've already created as the libraries, because we're going to be moving back to where I started from, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, in digital, you know, digital media services. So I'm going to be moving back where I started from, but I would like some way to brand it as a library service, or partially a library service.
Well, I mean, hopefully your awesome renovation that with the, you know, $13 million price tag is going to include some rebranding and some marketing, and just get in there and advocate that you think this needs to be wrapped into the broader vision and the broader message. Because you don't want to just glom on to some kind of like thing that they've already got going. You want your services to be part of the way that the entire institution is promoted. That's just my feeling about that, is that it's like, and the library does this. Well, you know, if you've got this huge initiative going to paint a new face on your library, then make yourself part of that face, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So figure out who's doing that work and just say, you know what, like, I want some prominence here.
I think it's an issue of outreach.
Yeah.
Also, and just not melting back into mm-hmm. my apartment.
Sure.
Just what they do.
Yeah. Yeah, just have a louder voice than than others.
Yeah. I think we're running low on time. Is there one last question?
I have the mic.
Well, if you got the mic, then go.
Oh, well, that's power. I kind of had a question regarding what Char said and what Amy said about the sense of kind of ownership, in a sense that on an academic level, students who tend to be more self-selecting have more of a sense of ownership mm-hmm. of the work they have. And with regards to personal publishing, that seems to be the case as well. Is there kind of a comfortable way to build on that in terms of branding? And are students or local publishers, if you will, comfortable with the notion of you kind of showcasing that to kind of promote the spirit of the library?
Lachlan, you want to take
that? Yeah, sure. So actually, in my real job, I run the repository at McGill University. And I agreed that word is terrible.
This
and all the words associated with it are too. Ingest, dump, repository. It's all terrible. It all sounds awful. But we do it. It's called eScholarship at McGill. And we highlight it in terms of this is the intellectual output of the university and something that we definitely want to include student work in, because you are the foundation of this university. And so we branded a lot. I do a session for postdocs on their online life as a postdoc, and I said, wouldn't it be awesome to have all of your papers in one spot, free, like full text searchable? I promise somehow to port them to whatever the next format is. Lord help me if PDFs ever die, which they will, I know. So that type of thing. And they love that because and it's a permanent link that they can put on stuff and just link to it. And so they're quite proud. Also, their name shows up with their supervisor's names in searches. Mm-hmm. And it gets great Google juice. So, I mean, they really, that is not, I don't have a hard time selling it to students, to be honest. Faculty is more difficult.
Yeah, right? Faculty sometimes it is a hard sell because they don't want to have their name associated with, you know, crappy product, and then you turn around and you say, well, it's your responsibility to help them turn out a good one. You know what I mean? Yeah. And that's kind of the part where the idea of mentorship comes in and you know, professorial ownership over the output of their own constituents. So, and that, I mean, that's where library education comes in. That's what I do. You know, talk to students about how not to infringe copyright, how not to plagiarize without realizing it, which is usually what's happening. And so those learning moments, that's where librarians are very important to kind of pick up that slack.
We're getting all kinds of signals that we gotta shut this down. So thank you all for coming.
We have goodies up front. Thank you.
Thank you.